Hey, it's Francis. This week, it's an episode from a while back about cold weather cooking with two vegetable experts. They say necessity is the mother of invention, and when it's the dead of winter and you're staring at a pile of turnips and not much else, well, that's when Amanda Cohen and Hetty McKinnon get excited. Check it out.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. You know, when people think of winter cooking, you know, most of the time their first thought goes to stews or big roasts and braises. Like you think of short ribs or a big pot of chicken soup. Now, I love all that stuff too. But I think vegetables get a bad rap in the winter. Like, no, okay, sure, there's no fresh corn or ripe tomatoes, but that doesn't mean the greens, the beets, the squashes, the roots, the mushrooms, and all that good stuff can't have some time in the spotlight. So this week, while the days are still too short, and the promise of spring sometimes feels like a sick joke, we still want to take some time to talk about cooking with vegetables. Later on the show, we'll have Amanda Cohen. She's the chef of the delightful all-vegetable-tasting menu restaurant Dirt Candy in New York. And we're going to start with Hetty McKinnon. She's a native of Australia, and Hetty one day started making creative salads in her home in Sydney and just started biking around town delivering them. And then, like, the legend of this salad clause spread far and wide, and she made a whole community around her love of vegetables and started writing recipes that would later become four acclaimed cookbooks of beautiful, beautiful food. Now she lives in the U.S. She's a recipe contributor to the New York Times, Bon Appetit, Food 52, and more. And her latest cookbook is To Asia with Love. Hey, Hetty, it's great to talk with you.
Hey, Francis.
So I want to talk to you about so many things. One is that you're like a champion salad maker. So actually, how did you get into salad? Like, what inspired you to become a salad master?
Well, this is a long story, and it really is. I'll do the short version. I'm a cook, and I started writing cookbooks because I made salads. Yeah. I had a salad delivery business in Sydney. Before that, I didn't cook, and I didn't want to be in food, but I started making salads and sharing them with my community in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with, you know, the power of food to connect people. And I started dreaming up these ways of feeding people so that they were nourished and comforted by a box full of vegetables. So that's where my love of salads started from.
I love a salad. I am not that good at making salad. I'll make salad at home, like as a you know, part of my dinner, and I'll be like, that's fine. Yeah. It never rises above the level of fine. So do you have like rules or creative guidelines?
Yeah, I do. Like, I've spent hours thinking about salad, and literally hours and hours. And, you know, it's every salad to me is a story, and that's the way I think of them.
Okay.
That cooking salads taught me how to cook, basically, because it taught me about the balance of texture and flavor and acidity and saltiness, umami, all those different things that we're trying to achieve in our food. Mm-hmm. So the salad was really such a vehicle, but there's definitely rules, I think. In one of my books, my very first book called Community, I re-released it in 2019 as an anniversary issue. And in there's actually an anatomy of a salad. So how to actually put one together with basic elements. So for me, my salads were always roasted or cooked vegetables. Okay. Sometimes they were shaved raw, but most of the time they were cooked and roasted with lots of flavor, maybe dusted in some spices or a spice blend. Mm-hmm. And then there would be that element that fills you up. You know, there's got to be that hearty element.
Okay.
So that would come from grains or legumes, sometimes even rice or noodles, something like that.
Okay.
And then there's got to be an amazing dressing that kind of ties those ingredients together. And then there's something to top it off. You got to create texture on the top. So whether that be nuts, seeds, And then a lot of herbs, or I say herbs, but herbs, because that kind of just brings brightness and a lot of excitement. So you could have like kind of an okay tasting salad, but if you add like a heap of mint or cilantro or basil or something like that, it just brings the whole thing to life. So, yeah, I have a lot of thought about salads. I could go on for a while, Francis, so you best stop me.
Yeah. Well, I love it. You know, it's even though I talk about food all the time, it's not every day I talk to someone who can say, I have spent hours thinking about salad.
And it's not even a lie.
But okay, so this is great because I also think, you know, given the season where we are, it's winter, you know, a lot of people don't think of salad as a winter food, right? Mm-hmm. But you said for your salads, often you start with a roasted vegetable, a cooked vegetable, something that is a little heartier. So how does winter produce excite you? And salad or not, you know, thinking about the vegetables that winter offers us, the produce that winter offers us.
Well, honestly, I think it might be controversial to say, but I think winter vegetables are more exciting for salads than, say, summer vegetables. Because summer...
Spicy take here.
Well, I honestly have always believed, and I actually started my salad business in Australia during the winter. I've honestly always believed that winter vegetables are actually, salads come to the fore during the winter. Say like a root vegetable. A lot of people aren't excited by root vegetables, but you've got, you know, sweet potato, squash, you know, like butternuts. Things that you can roast and you can inject so much flavor in the spices or the herbs that you add to it. And when you roast, say, a sweet potato, I've been really into sweet potatoes lately and I've just been roasting them whole, like the little ones. And they're syrupy, you know, they're so sweet inside. And you add that to, say, a grain or, you know, like chickpeas or something with a nice dressing, it's basically dinner done. And in the winter, I've been doing that a lot. It's just roasting like trays of vegetables that I get from either the supermarket or preferably the farmer's market at the moment. And, you know, I think winter vegetables are exciting, actually.
Yeah. So what are some things, I mean, you just mentioned the sweet potatoes, which sounds great. What are some dishes you've been putting together this winter that you've loved?
Well, I've got this thing going at the moment called, I call it my never-ending tahini dressing. So at the start of
legendary.
The week, oh, it's so good. Because tahini, you know, I'm vegetarian. So tahini is just such a wonderful ingredient in dressings because it can be used in lots of different ways and accented in lots of different ways.
That sesame nuttiness is so
and it just adds so much flavor in it. So it goes really well with like acidity, like you can add lemon juice and like lime if you've got it. And it just really like brightens it up. So what I've been doing lately, and I go through phases like everyone who cooks a lot, but this winter what I've liked to do is I make a tahini dressing at the beginning of the week and it's a really basic one. Say tahini and some water to thin it out, some garlic, some lemon juice. So basically it's a lemon tahini. And as I go through the week, so then I'll just serve that with whatever roasted vegetables I've got on hand. Sometimes I'll do it on a grain, I'll put slather over a grain salad. But as I go through the week, I also get bored of food really quickly, Francis. So I can't eat the same thing every single day. So as I go through the week, I'll add different things to the tahini dressing.
Oh, right on.
And top it up with more tahini. So it's like this, there's this base, but I'm constantly adding to it. So the other day added, it's a little nuts, but you know, we do crazy things at home when we're not developing recipes. but the other day I had this kind of leftover, it was from a Middle Eastern restaurant and it was the zug, you know, the cilantro dressing, the spicy cilantro dressing.
We're going to make an American out of you yet. You're going to call
cilantro. So there was the zug dressing and I added that to the tahini and it made this bright green spicy tahini dressing. So good. And then another time I added chili crisp to it. So I made this kind of chili crisp tahini dressing. So that's something that I really enjoyed doing this winter, and it's a bit of fun and it spices things up a bit. The other thing I've really loved is the hakarei turnips.
Japanese turnips, the really white ones, creamy.
They're so good. I'm a turnip fan, unashamedly, and I think that turnips are so underused and people just kind of don't know what to do with them. And I was kind of a latecomer to turnips. I mean, I think I was at a farmer's market when I still lived in Australia, and one of the stallholders said to me, you should just take this home, you know, cut it up, and then just saute it with butter and garlic. I did that, and it kind of opened my mind to the joy of turnips. But in the winter, you can get these hakareis, and you just slice them up, and you can, because they're not bitter at all, because they're so small. And they just add really nice texture to salads. So it just adds, you know, it stays crunchy. It's a fresh bite. And I love adding little elements like that to a salad just to make it a bit more interesting.
I'm a huge fan. Well, first of all, of the hakarei turnips, they're small. The biggest I've ever seen is maybe like a little bit bigger than a golf ball.
Yeah.
They're quite small. Really thin skin. They're often very creamy white, and they're so sweet. They don't have that bitter sharpness that turnips have. So raw, they're really nice, and roasted, they're beautiful. But they're also just so good. You can like just drop them into a sauce or something that's cooking or stewing, and they just, when they get soft when they poach, they're just so sweet and creamy. They're really, really lovely.
Yeah, I love them too. And I've been using them also in, good old Japanese curry.
Mm-hmm.
So, good old golden curry, you just get one of those things and chuck those little turnips in. And that's a great winter dinner, actually.
I am such a huge fan of Japanese curry. We've had a guest on before, Sonoko Sakai, who's amazing. And she has like a homemade Japanese curry recipe. But yeah, like I have no shame walking into an Asian, almost every Asian grocery will carry them, even though they're Japanese, even if it's not like a Japanese specialty store.
Yes.
And there are all these different brands, and they're just these little blocks that you saute up some vegetables and you add water and you just stir the block into the water, and it makes this like rich, creamy,
it's amazing,
sweet curry sauce.
And actually, I've made Sonoko's her curry bricks. I've made those and they are amazing, and she's amazing. But there's no shame in having those blocks in your pantry, because it's a quick dinner. It's like, 10-minute dinner if something cooks that quickly.
Yeah, I love it, love it. That's Hedy McKinnon, author of To Asia with Love. She'll be back with more ideas for winter vegetables in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hedy McKinnon's with us today. She's a writer, recipe developer, and author of the hit cookbook, To Asia with Love. And she's helping me take some of your cooking questions about winter vegetables. Let's get back to it. I want to talk to you about one recipe that you wrote recently for the New York Times before we get our listener questions, that uses instant ramen. The recipe is called crispy sheet pan noodles with glazed tofu. And this is amazing to me. I never would have thought of doing this, but it is a technique where you take the instant ramen noodles and you roast them on a sheet tray so they get crispy on the top and the bottom. Tell us about that. Just tell me. Walk us through
people,
the technique.
People love this recipe. It's been hugely popular, and it's really comforting and it comes together really quickly. But the genesis of that is there is actually another sheet pan chow mein recipe in my book To Asia with Love. I grew up eating chow mein, and proper Cantonese chow mein is very specific. It's like not just noodles thrown together in a wok and just tossed. It has texture. So the bottom of my mum's chow mein is crispy. It's almost like a cake, like a pancake crispy. And then the top is soft from the saucy top, which is usually some meat with vegetables.
Like
so
a
it's a saucy topping, like a gravy, yeah. And so there is a lot of texture going on with that particular dish. So what I'll try to do with the sheet pan version is to recreate that kind of juxtaposition of texture with the crispy bottom, which the high heat on a sheet pan is going to give you, with that kind of softness, those noodles that have gone a little bit soft from the sauce. And it's just this crazy riot of textures that comes together so easily. There's no real technique involved. All you need, basically your oven is doing the work for you, and you get this dish that for me is still very reminiscent of the dish that I grew up with. But instant noodles are so perfect because I think, you know, it's one of the things since quarantine, it's one of the things that everyone should have in their pantry because they keep forever and you don't know when they're going to come in handy. And so, for example, for the sheet pan chow mein, you don't even cook the noodles. You just soak them until they become, you know, just malleable, and then you just go for it. So,
and then you just roast it. And
yeah,
that's amazing. Because, yeah, I love the chow mein that you described. And yeah, if you're doing it properly, and I think this is more a restaurant dish than a home dish usually, but you take fresh noodles and you fry them. It's almost like pan frying them in oil. So that, like you said, like the pancake, it's crispy on the bottom. And then there's this whole technique to how you flip it, because how do you flip a whole batch of noodles? So like you have to be really skilled with your wok and your utensils and fry it so it's not greasy in the inside. But I have never attempted that at home. Never, ever, ever. But the idea that I can take instant ramen and roast it on a sheet pan till you get a similar effect, like, blows my mind. And I'm going to do it tonight, because actually, funny enough, I got a gift of a I got a delivery of my childhood brand of instant ramen as a gift. And I just realized I could just make your crispy sheet pan ramen tonight. So I'm going to do that.
But what is your childhood brand? I want to know.
Oh, Kung Fu brand.
Kung Fu brand.
Ah. Yeah. I don't know where it's popular or if it's popular at all. I just know it's this very tacky orange package that's never been redesigned since at least, you know, 1983.
Well, they can't be redesigned. Yeah, no way.
You can't do it. Can't do it. Okay, great. So let's go take some listener calls. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
All right. Let's start with Charlie.
Hi, it's Charlie in San Francisco. So I find myself craving meat a lot in the winter, you know, probably because it's cold, but also because I am a total, guiltily so, carnivore. And I'm wondering what are some good hearty meat replacements that I can slip into stews and soups, preferably something that isn't tofu, because I, you know, I cook a lot of tofu. And you know, I'm also wondering, can you even make a stew without meat? Is that possible? Is this the total pipe dream? Thanks.
Well, thanks for the call, Charlie. Yeah, it's a great question. You can absolutely make a stew without meat, but Hedy, let me ask you this. Like when someone, you know, as a vegetarian cook, as a recipe developer, when people come and ask you this question, does your brain go to, okay, is it a substitution question, or is it a, no, you actually think about the whole dish a little bit differently kind of question?
Yeah, think about the dish differently, I think. I think, you know, I don't even think with the mindset of meat and then let's replace it. You know, like my mindset's starting out from a different place because that's not an option for me. So, I think that we all have to kind of recalibrate how we think of a stew. Like I do really like this incredible, it's actually in the an upcoming book of mine, but this incredible like mushroom stew. And it's got like several different types of mushrooms. It's got dried like porcini in there. And it is so hearty that I don't think that you would eat that and think, oh, that doesn't have any meat in there. So it's incredibly, like I use eggplant in a stew, and I actually love it because I actually pre-roast the eggplant first to get it nice and soft. And then if it goes into the stew, it actually just sucks up everything it sucks up the sauce even, like it becomes really silky and just full of flavor. So that's something I really like to do. But even like a vegetable like carrots, I love making stews from carrots because they're so humble. And I feel like it's one of those vegetables that people don't give enough credit to because they think it's, oh, I'll use it for sofrito. I'll use it to start off a meal. But I'll buy a bag of carrots and make an entire stew. Like I can, I do this one dish where I braise it in a lot of olive oil and I add chickpeas and I add dates to it. So it's got a lot of rich flavors that we're looking for in the winter.
Do you do a liquid in there, like a broth or wine or something? Or do you...
It's basically like an olive oil braise, actually. Cool. And I do some lemons in there, and the lemons kind of break down as they cook. And so there's a lot of that. It's not a hugely saucy stew, but it definitely has that, you know, has that feel to it once it's done. And the carrots kind of fall apart. So it's really satisfying. But I think, you know, legumes is one to really look at for stews because I think they're a good base. Things like you could do, I've been buying these Rancho Gordo beans and you just, you know, cook a whole batch, make them into kind of brothy beans. And then you can kind of take elements, you know, take a batch out and make, say, a chili with it or something, and then use another batch for soups and then use another batch for stews. And the great thing about beans is they kind of do a double job. They're not only an ingredient, but sometimes I mash a little bit of them up just to add body to my vegetarian stew. So they're texturally, they're very useful in a stew, I think.
Yeah, totally. They give you that, it thickens it up. It gives you that richness.
Yeah.
Beans do a lot of the work that meat does in a typical meat-based stew, in the sense that they flavor the broth on their own and they give body to the dish. And so an example, I was making dinner one night earlier in the pandemic when, like, you know, grocery shopping seemed like a tricky thing to do. And I had some Thai red curry paste, which, you know, you make the red curry out of that, often just by like sauteing that curry paste, and then you add the coconut milk, and that curry paste has so much flavor that sort of creates your base. And then you can add vegetables and meats to that or whatever. And I didn't have meat, and I had some beans, some butter beans that I had cooked. So I just added the butter beans to this coconut Thai red curry, and it was so delicious. I'm like, I don't want to eat red curry any other way now. I want to eat it with butter beans. So Charlie, you can try things like that, or do what Hetty says, which is really think about building the dish on the vegetable to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you should do a red curry paste show, though, because I think that there's an endless conversation about all the things you can do with red curry paste. But that's another show.
I like that idea. All right, well, let's go to a non-curry question, and we'll go to Andrea.
Hi. What's your go-to cake recipe? My aunt used to make a pound cake that was her signature dessert. We all loved it. I kind of want a recipe to make my own that works every time. Thank you.
Right on. Hetty, are you a big baker?
I'm not, actually. Oh. I didn't grow up with baking. My mom never baked. And so I don't have a huge sweet tooth. So when I develop any sweet recipes, they're usually very basic. They're usually one bowl, not a lot of technique, and just really, you know, not a lot of decoration, because I don't really see myself as a baker. I do enjoy making certain sweet things, but I'm certainly a savory person. Thanks. That's a great question, Andrea. And I'm constantly looking for that kind of mother baking recipe too. And I think I developed it for myself in my book, Family. I've got in there, that's been a hugely popular recipe, is an orange and rosemary olive oil cake.
That sounds great.
So, yeah, it's so good. And what I'm always looking for in cake is moistness. A dry crumb just makes me run the other way.
It's so sad.
It's so sad. It's one of the life's saddest things is a dry cake.
The whole
cake.
Point of cake is it's a pleasure. So like when you eat it and it's dry, it starts to feel like a chore. And like, wait, why? why am I doing this?
Exactly. You're making a commitment to carbs and sugar and you're not even enjoying it. Yeah. So,
truly, what is the point?
I had to come up with a cake that kind of was assured to be moist at every turn. So this cake is not only an olive oil cake, but it also has yogurt in there and like a plain yogurt. And it's just, it's incredibly tangy and without being too sweet, because being Chinese, you know, I don't like anything too sweet, but it's very malleable. You can do lots of things to it. So the base recipe is, so really you start off by massaging the rosemary into the sugar and it kind of flavors the sugar with the orange zest. So it's very, I put the rosemary in there because that kind of brings the cake back to the savory side. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to do that. You can leave the rosemary out, but herbs are a wonderful way of adding, you know, perfume to cakes. I've also made it with blood orange and no herbs. You can do that. I've used lemons with some basil, really good too. Or you can just use like any kind of citrus. And I think that citrus is such a nice element to add to cakes because it just makes it less sweet and, you know, a bit more kind of perfumed and fragrant and fruity. So that to me is my base recipe, which I think you can endlessly riff on.
Right on. And we'll get that recipe from you later. Let's take one more question. Yeah. And this is from Lilia.
Hi, this is Lilia calling from Bozeman, Montana, and I'm calling with a question about braising greens.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of tired of the same old preparation, which has just been like lemon, olive oil, garlic, maybe some hot pepper flakes, sautéing them in a pan.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know that I can face that anymore. So I'm wondering if you have any recipe ideas for what to do with an abundance of braising greens. Hope you're well. Love the show. Thank you.
All right, Lilia. Well, thank you for that question. You know, I like a lemon, garlic, olive oil, sautéed green as much as the next person. But I'm like, let me tell you a secret on the radio for everyone to hear. But I'm kind of over it too. Like, I those are nice flavors, but I feel like there's this hegemony of olive oil, garlic, lemon, red pepper flakes with greens. It's the only way to eat greens. And it's like, that's, I don't know. I don't know why people think that. I mean, like growing up in a Chinese home, as you did, like, greens are everything, and they're cooked a thousand different ways. I don't understand why there's an assumption that those are the only flavors that go with greens. So what would you tell Lilia to play with first?
Okay. So I have a couple of thoughts. A, you know, speaking about greens in a Chinese household, I think Chinese families don't tend to braise greens very long. So it's usually like a quick braise. And one thing that I've been doing lately, and I've done it several times in the last 2 weeks, is I've braised lettuce. And I don't know if this is going to be mind-blowing, but lettuce cooked is just the most wonderful green ever.
I love it.
A slight edge of crunch, and it's so wonderful. So I braise that in just, you know, a concoction of soy sauce and sesame oil and, you know, kind of basic things that you have in your pantry. But that's just a different way of thinking about braising a different type of green, perhaps. But the other thing that I do, and it's, I think there's actually a recipe in my book Family, is that I braise a hell of a lot of spinach in coconut milk. So canned coconut milk. And then I think it starts off with, say, some aromatics, onion, garlic, then some spices like turmeric. I can't remember the other spice in there off the top of my head, but there's some spices in there. So you build this kind of, it's not a curry, but it just adds flavor. Mm-hmm. And then a hell of a lot of spinach goes in there. And so you've got this, a braised spinach, but you've got this coconutty, turmeric-y sauce, and it's really good. And I don't think you even think of that as braised greens, but it is, just with a different base.
Yeah, no, I love that. That sounds great. That sounds super great. And to come about the other side, you said, you know, if you're interested in cooking them longer, I love a very long, slow-cooked braised green. I love how silky they can get, and a lot of the greens that people avoid because they're bitter or because they're sharp, turnip greens, mustard greens, collard greens. You know, when you go to a southern restaurant, for instance, and you have the braised greens. You know, often they have meat in them, like maybe some ham hock or something. Sometimes you get them vegetarian, whatever. But I think a lot of the magic is just in simmering those greens for a long time. It could be in vegetable stock if you want to keep it vegetarian or vegan. It could be in, you know, a meat stock. It could even be, like you said, coconut milk or something like that. But just cooking them for a long time releases the silkiness. And I mean, depending on the green, it could be 10 minutes or it could be 30, 40. Or if you want to go hardcore and like let it simmer for 2 hours, you can do that too. But when you can just keep tasting them, and when they get silky, oh god, it's so good. And like,
it's so good.
You know, just make sure you're adding enough salt, maybe a little splash of vinegar, just to give it a little brightness at the end. Aromatics, like you say, onions, garlic, all those are wonderful. But the action of braising them is really special. And then, you know, just use whatever flavors you enjoy, whatever kind of stock, whatever kind of base. You're kind of not going to go wrong.
Yeah, I agree. I think collard greens are great for that because they're such a hardy vegetable, aren't they? There's a lot of texture to them to cook down, and they transform. They really transform, which I really love.
Yeah, and yeah, what's really great about them too is because the stem can be so tough and thick, if you braise them on the stem, like cut into big pieces, you braise them till the stem is tender. And then the leaves are actually, you get that silkiness. So there is still this nice difference in texture where you have like a really smooth, soft leaf, and the stem still gives you a little bit of chewiness. And I just love it. I adore it.
Oh, it sounds so good.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Hetty, so much. This has been such a blast talking winter vegetables with you.
Oh, thank you, Francis. It's been such a joy to talk about vegetables. Thanks for having me.
Hetty McKinnon's latest book is To Asia With Love. She left us a recipe for her amazing rosemary orange olive oil cake. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Chef Amanda Cohen of New York City's Dirt Candy. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Amanda Cohen is one of New York City's favorite chefs. Her restaurant, Dirt Candy, started almost 15 years ago, I think, as a tiny, tiny slip of a place. I think it literally had only 18 seats. And it was really one of the first modern, creative vegetarian restaurants in the city that I can remember anyway. And she was doing fun stuff, like grilling smoked broccoli and putting them in hot dog buns. And then the restaurant got better and bigger and weirder in a great way, like to the point where one of her signature dishes is a salad made out of ice cream. But behind the surprise and all the fun and whimsy, there's a chef who just really believes that vegetables are the most delicious, fun things to cook. And she's Canadian, so I figure she knows something about cold weather cooking too. And we caught up with her while she was in her restaurant getting ready for service. Hey, chef. It's great to talk with you.
It's so nice to speak with you.
Well, I am so glad to get a chance to talk with you. Because I really want to talk about winter vegetables. And, you know, I think there's this cliche of, oh, vegetable cooking is easy in the summer because you have great tomatoes and great corn. And that, you know, winter is when it gets grim. But I kind of imagine you don't feel that way.
I don't feel that way. No, I think winter is when it gets exciting. Winter is when you actually start to cook. In the summer, I feel like often you're just kind of putting things together. Like it's like cold salad making. And in the winter, it's when you actually get to be really creative and get out all the pots and pans and start to like really try new and different things and come up with creative ways to make them delicious.
Yeah, actually, I was looking at your restaurant menu yesterday, and you have delicata squash ribs.
Yeah.
What are those?
So we had this idea that we really wanted to make ribs and carve them out of squash. And actually, originally, we had really carved out like a set of like a chop roast almost. And we were putting the chop frills on top of the ribs to make it look like the roast. But now we've cut them up into little round ribs almost that we dip into a five spice barbecue sauce and we leave one end unsauced and they're smoked and a little deep fried and you pick them up and you can eat them with your hands and it's sort of basically the exact same thing as eating a rib except you're eating it with delicata squash.
Oh, man. That sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, it just sounds delicious, but that just sounds fun.
It is. Food should be fun.
Food should be fun. Okay, so like just thinking more of like a home cook vibe, because that sounds amazing, but it also sounds like a 9-step process.
It is.
If you're just like doing home cooking or just, you know, the starting point of inspiration for a dish before you've put all your techniques on it, what are some of your favorite winter vegetables? And, you know, what do you like to do with them?
Well, I know this is going to probably sound pretty boring, but it's hard to not love a good potato. Potatoes are so comforting, and it's something that I come back to all the time. And, you know, we've made noodles out of them. Right now, we're making like a tater tot pie stuffed with mashed potatoes. It's sort of like just trying to, you know, find new ways to keep ourselves interested in it. And then I also really, really like, apart from squashes, I really like greens. I like the hearty winter greens. I think there's so much you can do with them, from eating them raw or to like roasting them and grilling them and putting them in soups and pureeing them. And the thing that's nice about food in the winter is it usually takes a little bit longer to eat. It's either hot or it's chewier, and then it becomes actually so much more nutritious and so much more fulfilling. And something like a kale salad, yes, it's ubiquitous. Yes, we used to see it on menus everywhere. But we saw it on menus everywhere for a reason. It's delicious.
It's good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So let's go to some of our listener questions, because we've got so many of them. I don't want to take up too much more of your time before we get to them. And let's start with Don.
Hi, this is Don. I'm calling from Hudson, Massachusetts. And I have recently become enamored of cooking with small seedless tangerines or mandarin oranges.
Huh. Okay.
First recipe I used it for was to chop them up with the rind and all and add it to a muffin mix, and it was really a great addition. The next time I tried it was to create a little tomato sauce with the oranges I chopped up and some spices and herbs, and
That's
I
cool.
served that with ravioli, and it was also really good. So I'm looking for more things I can do with these seedless tangerines or oranges. Thank you.
I love this call. Don, I don't know who you are, but like, you're my new hero. It's like, I picked up a tangerine and I thought, I'm going to cook with this. I'm going to chop it up and put in muffins. Would have never thought of that. I will say I have made a tomato sauce. There's this old recipe in the Dean and DeLuca cookbook from 1992 or whatever. Like a standard marinara sauce, I think, but you squeeze a fresh orange worth of juice into it at the end, and it just brightens it up. It adds that sweetness. It's just such a cool combination I never would have thought of. What else would you do with tangerines?
Well, first of all, I'm fascinated because I've never thought of using the rind as well. So
yeah.
That's something I am going to have to try. I think that you're sort of like, the world's your oyster. You can now do whatever you want. You've sort of opened up
like
this. You
unlocked permission to
yeah,
add tangerines
totally.
To whatever.
I think baking them, we do that a lot actually with sort of that smaller citrus, is we'll just we'll peel it, but now I don't know how we'll get around the peeling of it, but we'll take the little segments and toss them in the oven with a little olive oil and salt and
cool.
bake them. Yeah, and then that's really nice on top of a salad.
I kind of can't imagine what that does. Is it like sort of melt them, or do they shrivel and dry?
I mean, it depends how long you leave them in the oven, right? You could put a little sugar on them, and then they'll get a little bit crispier, and they'll caramelize. Otherwise, they just sort of get really hot and juicy, and if you pull it out at the exact right time, they'll still be a little bit crispy with their skin before it starts to sort of, like, break. But it's delicious. I love the rind idea, but you could even toss those in, like, pasta for that, like, sort of really bright moment with another kind of protein.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the same way as you were talking about with that orange juice, you know, brought that sugar and that bright citrus moment. It would be the same thing as this, where you're just eating it with the rind. I don't know. I feel like you should go like crazy and like put it in cakes now and like soups and like everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've learned something.
Yeah, Don, we gotta get you over here, man. we should bring a sack of mandarins and go crazy. All right, let's go to Brian in Buffalo.
Hey, Francis, this is Brian in Buffalo, New York, and I am confused about leeks. But I'm never sure how much of the leek I can actually use when I'm trying to cook it. I've read that you should only eat the blanched portion of the stem, And usually I end up just cooking the white part and a little bit of the green part. But I don't like to waste food, even if it's going to go in the compost pile.
Sure.
So help me out. How do I use the most of my leeks?
Right on. This dude wants to conserve his leeks, and I'm all for it. Thank you, Brian. Well, first of all, speaking of little tangerines, I can totally imagine a beautiful poached leek with tangerine segments on top of that, like some nice olive oil, maybe something salty. Like that sounds like
perfect.
A really nice combination. But what is the deal with you're only supposed to use the white part of leeks?
So same thing, right, with what I was taught basically in cooking school with scallions too. People didn't like the color green. And so
is
you
that
didn't
it?
Use it. Yeah, I mean, they're a little bit, certainly in leeks, they can tend to be a little bit tougher. It's like the outer leaves of the leeks can be a little bit tougher as you get into the center. But really, it's a color thing. I know that they, this is going to sound really awful, but you know, they wanted to keep everything white.
Yeah.
So, no green, and they didn't want any discolorations or like muddiness, you know, sometimes, especially if you were blending something, it would turn it like gray or off white. But no, absolutely. Use the entire leek, not maybe the very, very outer leaves, because those can be quite tough. That's good for something like a stock. But for anything else, yeah, it's delicious. And there's actually more flavor in the colored part, because you're also getting sort of that chlorophyll part of it too, right? You get the leek plus the like the green flavor all in one.
Yeah. It is an onion. It's a member of the onion family, and you can use it that way to really nice effect. Like I really, really enjoy just slowly sweating thinly sliced leeks in butter until it's super soft and jammy. And just that on toast with maybe a little bit of Parmesan on top is just awesome. But I think like the old classic poached leeks with vinaigrette is crazy delicious, if you ask me. And you just cut a big old chunk of the leek, poach it gently in some stock. I mean, traditionally, I think you would use a chicken stock, but a vegetable stock would be totally great until it's really nice and tender, like where you can just stick a knife right through it. And some nice white wine vinaigrette on top of that is
classic
gorgeous.
And delicious.
Yeah.
I also really like raw leeks, cut very, very thin, tossed in a salad. You have to go thin, but it's sort of like, what's nice about a leek is it's an onion, but it has also this very different flavor. So it you know, it's like revisiting an old friend who you haven't seen for a really, really long time. You're like, oh, it's an onion, but it's different. My
changed.
Only recommendation. Yeah, because it's slightly milder than an onion, right? Not as garlicky as a shallot, but it sort of like works in between the two. And I'm a raw onion girl, so I love raw onions and everything. And I think a leek works just as well.
Oh, right on. All right, let's move to another one. Let's go to Adriana.
Hi, Splendid Table. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. My family, for probably over 100 years, has had this vinegar mother.
Oh, wow.
And now it's been given to me, and I don't know what to do with it. My mother inherited it from her mother-in-law, and never knew what to do with it. So she just shoved it in the back of the coat closet, and it's been there for 45 years.
Oh, wow.
Now it's mine, and I'm scared of it, but I think it's an important part of cooking, and I'd like to know what I can do with a 100-year-old vinegar mother. It might have come over with my grandmother from Calabria and come through Ellis Island, but I'm not sure. Thanks.
That's
so cool.
I mean, that's incredible. Wow, Adriana, thank you so much for sharing that. That's what a treasure.
First of all, I'm so impressed, and I kind of want to come meet your mother. that has so many stories in it. 100 years old plus, that's pretty amazing. You know, really all you do is you take that mother and you take some wine and you just pour the wine over the mother and let it sit in the dark place for like, I don't know, 2-3 months. And then it should make vinegar.
That's incredible.
That's as simple as it should be. That's what we've done here. And it's worked out really, really nicely. We've made white vinegar, red vinegar. We've made rosé vinegar. And it's so easy. You have to get the right bezel. Don't do it in plastic. Don't do it in metal.
Yeah, okay.
I think there's those like vinegar crock pots that you do it in. And because, you know, that vinegar, the mother's just sat there by itself for so long. Don't use the whole mother before you waste it. Maybe take half of it. I don't know how big it is. Somehow I just imagine this giant blob living in the back of the closet.
Taking over the closet. It's trying on their clothes.
Just growing. You know, like... Basically, like, use me. Stop forgetting about me. And then take a bottle of wine, pour it over, and see what comes of it. This is to me like a podcast, like something like, you know, we should hear stories about for years to come. Yeah, yeah.
Is there a way to know if the mother is still alive? I mean, did they go bad?
I just don't think it dies. It's not like you have to feed it like a sourdough starter. It might be a little dry. It may take some time to revive, but I really think that it should be okay. I assumed it was kept in some sort of appropriate jar, but, you know, it wasn't in like a shoebox.
Chilling in the back of the closet. What an incredible thing to be able to do, to bring back a 100-year-old vinegar mother and start making vinegar out of it.
It's like history in a bottle. It's really neat.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so since we're on the subject of vinegar, let's go to Andrea.
Hi, my name is Andrea, and I'm in Oakland, California, and I love salt and vinegar chips, but I want to snack on something healthier, so I wanted to roast my own salt and vinegar almonds at home. What is the best way to infuse a lot of that salt and vinegar flavor on those nuts, and what are some pro tips to get them tasting really good and not have them be too burnt? Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrea. Jeff, you're a fan of snacks. I know this about you.
I am. So I'm going to actually tell you the best cheat, actually. And I hope this doesn't lower my like chef cred. But you can buy salt and vinegar powder.
There you go.
I mean, it's just the easiest thing to do. We've used it in the restaurant before. It's made to stick to chips and nuts, and it's delicious. We buy it at a store in New York City called Calustians, but I'm sure you can find it online. And then you just sort of roast whatever you want to roast. When they come into the oven, you toss it in there, and it's the best snack. We used to do dehydrated kale chips, which we did sometimes in the oven or in our dehydrator, and then we would pull them out and we would toss them in the salt and vinegar powder. And you had like the best healthy snack.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds super great. And just to talk about the nuts and not to burn them, I think a lot of people want to toast nuts at a higher temperature. And I mean, you can totally do it, but you'll want to toss them a lot and make sure they're not burning. I just think like, just turn the oven down and you can totally toast nuts at 350. You don't have to like whack them with like crazy high heat. And it might take a while, depending on how many nuts. It might be 5 minutes, it might be 10 minutes, but they'll just kind of like crisp up more evenly. They'll brown a little more evenly. And then when they're smelling, when you start to smell them, I would take them out of the oven then and then toss them with the salt and vinegar powder when they're hot.
I agree with you, except I would say go even lower.
Really?
Yeah. One thing is now, you know, every oven is really different,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, too. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm really into low and slow. So like I would go down to 300 and just give it the time it needs, because that crispiness is going to come from it's losing its moisture, right?
Yeah,
so the longer
yeah.
it's in there, the crispier it's going to be. And then you can sort of maybe like turn it up for a couple of minutes at the very end. But really, the low and slow. I think we've all been taught to be afraid of any temperature in an oven less than like 325 degrees. And yet they all are there. They exist. We need to get to know them.
Those are our temperature neighbors, too. Get to know your temperature
exactly.
neighbors. Well, all right, Chef. This has been a lot of fun. I know you're getting ready for service, so thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. You as well. Thanks for having me on again.
Amanda Cohen is the chef of the vegetable-focused restaurant Dirt Candy in New York. You can find a recipe for her chickpea, tomato, and rosemary soup at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed it. And remember, if you ever have any cooking questions for us, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.